We've covered a lot of material up to chapter 6, verse 21. And what I have found in studying this book is the necessity to keep in mind a running summary of what we have done up to a given point in time. Without keeping in mind a running summary, it is easy to get lost in the nitty-gritty of the text. So what I propose to do is to give you a very quick summary in short sentences of what we have covered up to chapter 6, verse 30. Then we will do the concluding verses 31 through the end of the chapter, and then we will complete chapter 7. So how do we summarize the considerable material we have covered up to now? We can summarize it in the form of three statements. The first statement is God's proposition. God declared, Job will never fail me. Job will never fail me. To which Satan at the heavenly court rebutted or tried to rebut God by saying, the only reason Job is faithful to you is it pays to be faithful. So God's rejoinder to that blasphemous statement was, fair enough, put Job to the test. Only his life is sacrosanct. All else about Job is fair game. So that gave Satan the green light to go ahead and to test and to prove to God that Jehovah was wrong, and that the reason, the only reason that Job was faithful is because he had an ulterior motive. It paid handsomely to be faithful to God. As a consequence of God agreeing to put Job to the test, the following consequences started to occur. First and foremost, Job was stricken. But you will recall that he was not stricken all at once. He was stricken with increasing severity. First, there was material loss, which, though great, a person can generally cope with. Then came personal loss because his children were killed, and that also all together at one blow. So there's material loss. There is personal or family loss, and these, you must remember, are coming quick on the heels of one another. It was mentioned that generally human beings can cope with problems or disasters if they come one at a time. If we think about the situation in Japan, if it had only been the earthquake, I'm pretty sure that they would have coped, because they live with earthquakes and aftershocks as a daily facet of life. But it's a combination of disasters when they come together at the same time, the earthquake and immediately after the tsunami. It stretches not just the individual, but it stretches the whole nation to breaking point. So this was the added difficulty for Job. This was in itself the additional test embedded in the individual test to which he was subjected. Namely, that all of these individual tests were coming either at the same time or one after the other in rapid succession, which means that before he has time to recover or compose himself, he's hit with the next disaster. So bear in mind that the rapidity and the sequencing of the test is itself a test. Then he looks for support to the one person who is closest to him, his wife, and we saw that she was so broken by the problems that came quick on the heels of one another that, and this was a difficult point we had to grapple with, did she abandon her faith in God as many people seem to think, or did she just make an emotional outburst. It is easy to be uncharitable to the wise, but if you read the whole book of Job, you will find that nowhere does Job blame her. When he speaks to her, he speaks in words that clearly indicate his sympathy for her. He tells her, "You speak like one of the foolish women." He doesn't accuse her of being foolish herself. "It was my daughter who made this observation to me." She's 23 years old. She said, "Let me tell you, Daddy, where a woman is concerned, when emotion comes in, reason goes out of the window." So I thought that this 23-year-old had actually taught me something about life which I didn't realize. So perhaps Job realized that where women are concerned, with all due respect to them, they are our mothers and our wives and our girlfriends. Where emotion comes in, reason tends to fly out of the window or go into exile. So that being the case, the words of Job indicate sympathy and understanding. And we will find at the end of the book that he had 10 children, no mention of the wife, and it is safe to conclude that this second crop of 10 children were born by the same woman, because otherwise the text would have told us that Job had remarried, of which there is absolutely no mention. So he is not so much abandoned by his wife, but she becomes a liability because she has broken down. She can't cope with the stresses and strains. So in addition to all of the trials and the fact that they have come one on the other, on the heels of the other, it's a fact that the one closest to him has become now an added liability because she has broken down. Then he looks for support to the three closest friends he had, because they came of their own accord to see him. And it is natural for us to look to our friends for support. But lo and behold, what Job found is that they may have come with good intention, but they had completely misunderstood his predicament, and rather than comfort him or encourage him to wait on God, they started finding fault with him. So this was now an additional trial which Satan allowed to come on Job. We saw that Satan loves to play mind games, and what he had done in the spirit visitation to Eliphaz before the trip started was to sow those seeds in Eliphaz's mind, which, having sown the seed, Satan then draws back to watch the fun. And Eliphaz, being a man of intelligence, dwells on these seeds of thought and builds it up into an argument that afflictions are always, this is not correct, always the result of sin. So Job is guilty of very great sin. All he needs to do is to confess. When this is drummed into the ears of Job, it becomes exceedingly painful, because now the final support that he had, wife also misunderstood him, she's broken down, she's a liability. All the friends of his hometown have deserted him. We are told he was seated outside the city gate because he was treated like a leper. And not knowing the cause of the illness, it was sensible of him to isolate or quarantine himself. There's no mention that the townspeople forced him out. He voluntarily exiled himself, or quarantined himself would be a better word, in case the disease with which he was afflicted was infectious. So now the last measure of support that a person would have, that is one's close friend, that's also crumbled. And now the stark reality of it all: if all your props and my props are taken away, and all we have left is a testimony of our conscience before God, will that testimony be clean and pure? It is easy for us to be good Christians or appear to be strong Christians when there are lots of props supporting us. We may not realize this, but each one of us is actually supported in our daily lives and enabled to do useful things for the Lord because there are unseen props which are holding us up. For example, the love and affection of our parents, of our family members, are powerful supports that we have, the support and understanding of close friends. But all of these can be taken away for one reason or another. When all of these are stripped away from you, will you still have a clean conscience before God? Very few of us can say that even if I have lost all these external means of support, my faith in God is enough. Very few of us can actually stand up and say that. And I don't think any Christian would dare to claim that for himself. Certainly Job never did. But in reality, as these props were taken away from him, all he had left was his faith in God. So the first discourse of Eliphaz, the first argument, is in chapters 4 and 5. What this self-styled sage has to say can be summarized in 4 points. First point, the premise that affliction is always, this is Eliphaz's viewpoint, affliction is always the result of sin. Therefore, the greater the sin, the greater the affliction. So far, very logical. Now it is applied to the case of Job. If affliction is always the result of sin, greater the sin, greater the affliction. Apply it to Job, the inevitable conclusion is because his afflictions are so great and so sudden, his sin or sins must be correspondingly great. If that is so, then the only way Job is going to be delivered is when he stops trumpeting his innocence and throws himself upon the mercy of God. If you put these 4 points together by human understanding, it's a watertight argument. It's very difficult to break this argument. But you see that what has happened is the manipulation of Satan. For Eliphaz to give Job this kind of reasoning, which is humanly speaking watertight, his mind had to be conditioned and tuned to think this thing out in these 4 points. And very clearly we can see the manipulation of Satan. And this is one of the tricks of the evil one. Seldom does Satan attack us directly, because if he did, we can rebut him directly. But more often than not, the temptations of Satan are very subtle. It's a hint here, a suggestion there, a doubt here, a doubt there. And then Satan, having planted that, withdraws. And he leaves it to our own intelligence to brood upon this and develop it. And then when we sin, Satan can rightfully say, I didn't cause so and so to sin, he or she sinned, which would technically be correct, because ultimately if your actions or your words constitute a sin before God, you cannot actually blame the devil. The devil can tempt you, can attempt to lead you astray, but if you do go astray, you cannot rightfully stand before God and say he's responsible. You are responsible because God gave you the capacity for rational thinking, for decision making. So ultimately Satan gets away with clean hands and you are left facing the judgment of God. So Eliphaz's words, you must remember, are the result of Satan's manipulation of his mind. Chapter 6 is taken up with Job's rebuttal. And Job's rebuttal can be summarized in 4 points again. We haven't completed chapter 6, but let's look at the summary in 4 simple points before we go on. First point, Job says, my life is an open book. Neither by word nor by deed have I ever failed God. Which is true. Everyone acknowledged that he was a perfect and an upright man, not sinless, but he was as good as a human being could be. Second point in Job's rebuttal is this: if, as you say, Eliphaz, my afflictions are so great, meaning my sins have to be correspondingly great, then does it not occur to you that if my sins are so great, wouldn't they be beyond concealment? To which we would have to say, indeed so. Because that is the whole point of Eliphaz's convoluted argument, that you, Job, must be having some terrible sin. So Job is thinking this through. In the midst of all his suffering and pain and heartache, his mind, and I am amazed at the strength of his intellect, is reasoning through at the same time the significance of Eliphaz's words, picking flaws in his argument and telling Eliphaz, okay, here's my second point, my good friend. If my sin has to be that great to induce God to punish me so severely, then that sin would be beyond concealment. So you should be able to point it out to me. But, and this is the third point, up till now, you, Eliphaz, have failed to identify a single one of the sins that you claim I'm guilty of. And the fourth point, very appropriate. He tells Eliphaz to the face, look, I never called for you. I didn't ask you to come over and do me a favor to sit beside me. The three of you came of your own accord. You came here to say that you are my friend. You have come to comfort me. But all you have done is vilify me, make me out to be a monster. And in so doing, you have broken the covenant of friendship. It is part of the deal, if you want to look at it that way, part of the covenant of friendship that we have with another person, that we will not take the worst view of things that the person does, but we will be charitable because that person is known to us over so many years and we trust him or her. We are willing to do our best for that person. So when that person appears to be in trouble, we don't take the worst case scenario and apply it to the person. That is part of the covenant of friendship. We are always biased, if you want to think of it in that sense, biased towards our friend. So we will take a more cautious interpretation and give our friend, wherever possible, the benefit of the doubt. That's part of what goes to make up strong friendship, as contrasted with a mere acquaintanceship. So Job's rebuttal, summarized in these four points, occupies verses 21 through 30 of chapter 6. And this is a section which we did not cover last week. In this section, there are only a few verses that need to be highlighted because their meaning may not be clear. So let me draw your attention first to chapter 6, verse 21, where Job says, for now ye are nothing, ye see my casting down, and are afraid. What does this really mean? This is really a scathing criticism of the three friends. What Job says is, look, you came here giving me hope, just as a traveler in the deserts of Arabia would look for the supply of fresh drinking water to those streams that are known to travelers. And when I come to the spot where I would expect to find such a life-giving stream, all I find is it has dried up. In winter time, when travelers don't need the additional supply of water, the stream is full. But in summer, when the same journey has to be undertaken, when the traveler or travelers need supplies of fresh water to keep them on their journey across the desert, they find that the streams have all dried up. And in that sense, he says, you are as nothing. You came here supposedly as streams in the desert. But when I tried to drink, to draw in support from you, I find that you are all dried up. And what Job says as a tribute as to the cause of this turnaround is extremely significant. He says that it is done out of fear. And in that, I believe he's completely right. And the reason is this: it is not obvious when reading the text. But if you put two and two together, you will have to agree that Job is absolutely right. What could have induced these three, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, to do an about turn? It is fear. Fear of what? Fear that their argument about the connection between affliction and sin is wrong. And if Job is correct that the afflictions he is enduring are not related or not the consequence of prior sin in his life, then the implication is very frightening. The implication is the three of them, who are also like Job, upright in their community, are liable to be stricken by similar afflictions for no rhyme or reason other than that God so permitted it or ordained it. And they couldn't countenance their thoughts. For them, it is easier to understand and cope with the kind of troubles that Job is going through if they can in their minds make this connection. Affliction means sin. If I don't have this kind of unconfessed sin in my life, I shouldn't have affliction. Hooray. That they can grasp. In situations of turmoil or disorder or chaos, the human mind always tries to see reason or a pattern. And this is part and parcel of what you might call the survival instinct, which is why when psychologists administer the ink dot test, where ink is splashed, or I don't know if they still do it nowadays, but when it was practiced, the ink dot test went like this. The patient would sit before the psychologist, and the psychologist would show him sheets of paper on which ink had been spattered. And of course, the spattering pattern of the drops would be unique between one print and the next. And the thing that the patient has to do is, upon looking at each of these ink drop spatter patterns, to tell the psychologist, what does this resemble? I do not know how from the reply the psychologist will deduce what is troubling the patient. I suspect there is a bit of quackery in this. Be that as it may, it is based on the ability, or even you can say the tendency of the human mind, particularly in times of chaos and disaster, to see some kind of reason in it, to see some kind of pattern in it, because that is the only way the human mind can cope with disasters and with trials which are beyond a certain stage of severity. If the human mind didn't have this as a last resort, that person would have a complete mental breakdown. So this is a way of coping with such situations. So what Job is saying is, it is because of your fear that you could be stricken down that is leading you to make this connection between my afflictions and some kind of secret sin in my life. What is admirable is this: for a person under such kind of severe mental, emotional, bodily duress, that he still has the resilience of mind to reason, to think through, and to find the gaps and the flaws in the reasoning of Eliphaz is a tribute to the strength of his intellect. And that is one of God's blessings to him. He's still able to, as it were, fight back. The next verse which is worth touching on is verse 24, where Job says, "Teach me and I will hold my tongue, and cause me to understand wherein I have erred." What Job is saying in this verse, I don't know if it comes across clearly, it's just this. It's all right for you to criticize me, Eliphaz, but please make sure that your criticism is constructive. It is very easy to find fault with somebody else. It is less easy to go to the person and say, I realize that you have this problem, but here's what you can try out to cope with the problem, because I went through something similar some years ago. That is a constructive approach to helping somebody versus the critical or destructive approach, which is easy to do, is to go up to the person and say, you are wrong, this is what you have done is completely wrong. That may be true. How does it help that person to recover if all you can leave that person with is negative criticism? And this is, if we are ever put in a position of counseling others in the church or in our circle of friends, we must bear in mind this piece of advice that Job is giving Eliphaz. Indirectly, he's saying, please approach this with the intention to be constructive in your criticism. If you really want to help me, says Job, guide me so that I can see for myself where I have gone wrong. I will not argue with you whether I am right or wrong. If you can show me where I have gone wrong, you would have killed two birds with one stone. You would have got me to agree that I have this secret sin, and more importantly, you would have helped me to see what I need to do to address that particular sin, rather than hitting me with a big broad bat that says, you have sinned. Fine, what is that sin? If you remember the woman caught in adultery, the charge against her was very specific, and the response of Jesus was directed to that specific sin. Even though he concluded his dialogue with the woman by saying, neither do I condemn you, go and sin no more. The reference in that phrase, sin no more, is specific to what had got her into this predicament, which is adultery. So in all the criticism that Jesus leveled against people, but even against the Pharisees, it was always directed to them, but with a view to help them get out of it. It is just that because of pride and arrogance, the Pharisees could not see that Jesus was leading them not just to acknowledge their sins, but providing them with a resource to deal with those sins. So it was, as they say, water off a duck's back. And unfortunately, Job's advice is also going to be water off a duck's back where his friends are concerned, because they were not in a position to give him constructive criticism. That's verse 24. Verse 26. Do ye imagine to reprove words and the speeches of one that is desperate, which are as wind? Here what is happening is Job is accusing Eliphaz, and justly so, on dwelling upon his outburst and not taking into account the fact that Job is on the brink of a complete breakdown, and that in those circumstances the words that a person speaks may appear to be very extreme. But if we don't give allowance for the emotional state of that person, we can end up doing far more damage by taking a severely critical view of the person. So in helping, particularly when it comes to pointing out the faults to the person we are dealing with, we must be very sensitive to the whole context. Make an effort to learn the background of that person, the background of what got that person into this trouble, before we start telling the person, you know, this is wrong and that is wrong. So what Job is saying is, why do you latch onto my words? You know that I am beside myself. So there are times when I don't think clearly, I react in an emotional way. You can't just pick on these things and then use them as arrows to hit me again. In telling Eliphaz this, perhaps Job was mindful of his own wife. When she gave that outburst telling him to curse God and die, he showed his understanding, because his reply to her was, don't talk like a foolish woman. Think through what you have to say, because you are accountable for your words. That should be the way, says Job, Eliphaz and his friends should have approached him. But unfortunately, they didn't. It's verse 26. Verse 27, yea, ye overwhelm the fatherless, and ye dig a pit for your friends. In this verse, there are just two words that need to be explained. The first is overwhelm. And literally, what it means, if you look at the Hebrew word, is to fall upon and consume. In the jungles of Amazon, there is a type of species of ant called, I think, the fire ant. And what they do is, when a living creature gets in the way of their movement, they follow certain very defined tracks in the jungle, on the jungle floor. And if any creature is unfortunate enough to cross their tracks, they swarm over. If you have seen Discovery or National Geographic, you would have seen pictures of this. They swarm over the creature. It could be a large creature like a monkey or even a large bird. But if it gets in their way, they immediately swarm all over the creature, sting it, render it helpless, and start eating it up. So keep that picture in mind when you read what Job is saying to Eliphaz. He overwhelmed the fatherless. You are swarming on me like those fire ants, disabling me, and then you are going to eat me up. A very graphic picture of what they are doing to him. But why does he bring in the word fatherless? This is a bit tricky here. Yes, literally the Hebrew word yatom means an orphan. But if you check the Brown Driver Briggs lexicon, you will find that there are situations where that same word, yatom, does not mean literally an orphan, but it can be used to describe a person who is lonely and who is helpless. So between these two meanings, orphan, lonely and helpless, the context would guide us to see it is the second meaning that should be attributed to this word. So if you agree with that, then verse 27 can be rephrased to read as follows in modern English. Job's words to Eliphaz and his friends. Indeed, you fall upon one who is as lonely and helpless as an orphan. You take his words out of context and attack him based on a distorted interpretation of his speech. As hunters, you seek to trap your friends using words. So this is the amplified version, as I understand it, of verse 27, which in the original reads, ye overwhelm the fatherless, and ye dig a pit for your friends. Now we look at verse 29. Return, I pray you, let it not be iniquity. Yea, return again. My righteousness is in it. What on earth does Job mean, return, I pray you, return again? What I can suggest is that this verse indicates that Job's three friends were preparing to take leave of him. They had given up on him and they were going to take their leave of him. But what Job is saying in verse 29 is this: look, I haven't finished my argument. do this for me, hear me out. I need to go, I need to elaborate on my argument. And I'm sure that if you hear me out, you will realize that I am innocent. But I haven't completed what I have to say. So please don't go. I have more things to add on. And that, I believe, is the best way we can understand verse 29, where Job says, return, I pray you, return again. So what happens is the impact of his words persuade the friends to stay back instead of leaving him as they may have wanted to do. And this appeal to them in verse 29 to stay back and hear him out and not just turn away and go back, this appeal is reinforced by verse 30, where Job says, is there iniquity in my tongue? Cannot my taste discern perverse things? What he is saying is this: look, I am well qualified to judge between true and false. Therefore, why don't you give me the benefit of the doubt? Just as the human palate and the back of the tongue are fitted to distinguish between the various tastes, sweet and sour, salt, and so on, so too, by the things I have gone through in my life, I am well qualified to judge between the true and the false. So, he tells Eliphaz, give me the benefit of the doubt, hear me out. He succeeds in gaining their attention, and that's where in chapter 7 he elaborates the case for his innocence. However, in chapter 7, the whole chapter is actually an address to God. It may not appear that way at the outset, but in chapter 7 he is not talking to the friends, and you must be aware of this, otherwise the opportunity for misinterpretation is there. He is now, though the friends are gathered around him and they obviously can hear what he is saying, his attention is now on God, and what he is going to say in chapter 7 is directed to the Lord. We have to bear in mind a very important aspect of this. Job was unaware of the spiritual dimensions of his trials, and because of that, because of this ignorance, it was doubly difficult for him to bear that trial. And is it not so with us? If we knew the reasons why we undergo a certain piece of suffering or trial, it is easier to bear. Than in the case where we have been doing the right thing and obeying God, and then we are struck by one affliction after another. In that kind of situation where we can't see the connection between any unconfessed sin in our life and the afflictions that are coming upon us, we find it even more difficult to bear than if we knew the reason. If God were to tell us, I'm going to test you, so be prepared. If I'm not mistaken, wasn't this one of the BB boys' motto, be prepared? Scouts. Okay. The scout's motto is be prepared. It would be wonderful if God could tell us be prepared and give us an insight into what's going to happen. Be prepared, because in the next 3 weeks I'm going to strike you down with a rash all over your body. But you are not to miss church on that account. Make sure that you come to church. If that reason is given, the rash may be uncomfortable, painful, but we know that it is, God has ordained it, not because of my sin, but the Lord wants to try me and strengthen my faith. So fair enough, I will bear it bravely. I will come to church and prayer meeting and ladies fellowship and family Bible fellowship and youth fellowship for the next 3 weeks, so that I can stand before God and say, look, I have obeyed. But do you realize that very, very seldom does the Holy Spirit give us advance warning. Very seldom. One of the classic cases and one of the rare cases in the whole Bible where the person being tested was given an advance warning was none other than Peter. Remember when Jesus said to him, Simon Peter, I am paraphrasing here, Satan hath desired to have you, and he will sift you like wheat. But when you are restored, you go and strengthen your brethren. So Peter was given an advance warning. Unfortunately, as events proved, he did not pay heed to that advance warning. Had he done so, he would not have to be rebuked by Christ. And he was given a second advance warning, because in the courtyard of the high priest's palace, shortly before Jesus was brought to trial, Jesus said to Peter, before this night is over and the cock crows, you will deny me thrice. Again, this unfortunate man paid no heed to the advance warning. So maybe it makes sense for God not to tell us in advance, because if we take Peter as representative of us as average Christians, then even if we are told in advance that we are going to be tested from the 23rd of March to the 30th of March, we are still going to end up committing the same old sins. So why tell us? So we can excuse God, if you want to put it that way, from keeping us in the dark. But the point is that very seldom are we privileged to know the reasons for our trials, and we are certainly very rare that we are given advance warning. So how do we cope with this? In a sense, the scout's motto, be prepared. How do we prepare ourselves? Again, the advice that Jesus gave, watch and pray. Pray without ceasing. That is the way we keep ourselves always in a state of readiness, because God is never going, or seldom if ever, going to tell us in advance. So each day, and this is why the Bible tells us repeatedly, why do you worry about, and these are Jesus' own words, why on earth do you come here with your face drawn and your shoulders stooping, telling me you're concerned about next week, about how you'll survive all the way to prayer meeting on Friday, when all the Lord wants you to do is to cope with Monday. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. If you can cope with Monday and live it productively for the Lord, no matter what comes, then Monday night you pray and ask God for grace to cope with Tuesday. And that is all the Lord is asking of us. Fight each day's battle one day at a time. The problem always comes about because we have itchy fingers and we are not content to live one day at a time. We want to live the next 30 years of our life. We want to have the advanced plan of our life. Many companies do this 5-year, 10-year planning, and I've in the past been involved in such exercises. But looking back, I realize that it's all a joke. I mean, the intention is good to be prepared, and companies need to be prepared. But who in the company, from the CEO downwards, can actually see 5 years into the future, particularly given today's working environment? You can see 1 year into the future, that's already wonderful. So I remember Reverend Toth, when it came to budgeting, he always had a key approach to it, which is quite unique. He says, our budget is a no budget. By that he didn't mean don't think about the issue. He says, you do your part to plan, but please don't get caught up in this planning, detailing, the micromanaging, that $20.39 will be spent buying art and craft material for the orphans in Yangon. $39.29. It's pointless going down to plan, pointless planning to that fine level of detail, because you may not be around next week to send the $39.29 to Yangon anyway. But far better to say, they need help, and in general they need it in the form of books, educational material, medicine, food, and be guided by that on a day-to-day basis rather than micromanage day 1, day 2, day 3, day 4, day 5, day 6 and then come to church on Sunday saying, I'm worn out. God didn't wear you out. You wore yourself out by this drive to manage the whole of your future. Right now you want a 25-year plan from God and you want God to consult you before he drafts this 25-year plan or 30-year plan, so that if you are up to the age of 30, for the next 30 years you have a detailed plan from God how your life is going to shape up. It doesn't happen. It's a fantasy world like Alice in Wonderland. So don't waste time micromanaging your future. Leave it to the Lord. There is a pattern in chapter 7, and you may like to take note of it. Verses 1 through 6 is a lament. Job laments the physical and emotional pain he has had to endure. That's verses 1 through 6. Verses 7 through 10 is a petition. Job petitions God to restore to him the joy of life. Then the third part, verses 11 through 16, Job complains bitterly to God. And finally, verses 17 through 21, Job petitions God for a reprieve. So as said earlier, although Job is addressing God, the friends are listening in on his discourse because they are right there with him. What is significant is as we go through chapter 7, we realize that the content of what Job had to say in his address to God in chapter 7 is going to provoke the second of his three friends, Bildad, to respond. And that response is couched in the words of chapter 8. We will stop here and go into chapter 7 in more detail, God willing, next week.